Hello and welcome to History Gap. I'm Georgia McAndrew.
And I'm Molly Goodfellow. History Gap is a podcast that bridges the gender gap and tells you all about the badass women from across history and culture. This episode is brought to you with a special collaboration with the National Trust podcast.
Look at us, a special collaboration.
I know.
Who would have thought it?
Not me.
This week on the podcast, we are talking about Ferguson's Gang. Have you ever heard of Ferguson's Gang, Molly?
I haven't, not before we started researching this podcast.
Have you ever been in a gang?
No.
Do you want to be in a gang?
Are you inviting me to be in a gang?
We could form a gang.
Should we use the History Gap gang?
Gang?
We'll get jackets.
Oh.
With like studs on the back.
And some hair gel.
Yeah.
That would be nice. But you might want to be in Ferguson's gang after I've told you this story. It's quite a good one.
Let's go.
Ferguson's gang was formed in 1927 during a picnic at Tothill Fields in London. As they sat having a picnic, the conversation turned to many issues of the day, but one was most pressing: the increase in building developments around the country. In their view, the great British countryside and its history was being stripped of its beauty, invaded by developers, and so on. In the 1920s, after the First World War, the country was going through a lot of change. Work was being done to build more roads and more housing across the country, and this meant that the picturesque landscapes that England is so well known for were under threat. However, there was one event that particularly inspired the ladies, and that was the jeopardy that befell Stonehenge in the 1920s. For any listeners, Stonehenge is that kind of big thing made out of rocks in the south of England. You can slow down and look at it if you're driving on the A303, I think it is. Definitely put there by aliens.
Well, Stonehenge?
Yeah.
Yeah, or witches. Or witches. Alien witches.
Alien witches could be cool, to be fair.
Yeah.
We have one of those, like Stonehenge in Scotland.
What's it called?
Oh, fuck, I meant to look this up before you get here.
I'm sorry.
It's so annoying. I read things, I'm like,
does it look
to
exactly
do that?
The same?
What should I even Google? Not Stonehenge in Scotland.
Scotland's Stonehenge.
Oh, ours are called the, I don't know how to pronounce that, the Callanay Standing Stones?
Cute. Which came first?
This one was around 5,000 years ago. They predate England's famous, in your face,
classic,
predate England's famous Stonehenge monument.
England's so shit.
We got 3,000 years on you.
But we shout louder, so.
Well, that's
who's
true.
The real winner?
Now Stonehenge, at this point, was already a national treasure. It had been bought by a man called Sir Cecil Chubb, excellent name, a barrister who wanted to protect the stones from overseas buyers. He purchased Stonehenge for £6,600, which in today's money sits around £563,000. Big spender, Sir Cecil Chubb.
Yeah, that's like the price of someone's first home that he just like splurged on Stonehenge.
Mm.
Baller.
Also, imagining him having that much money back then.
Yeah.
He was a big spender. Wonder if he's single.
Is there a Mrs. Sir Cecil Chubb?
Once purchased, he donated the site back to the public, so no one could build within certain parameters. Everyone was very happy about this. Sir Cecil Chubb was even made a baron by the Prime Minister Lloyd George for his generosity. However, although the Stonehenge stones were protected and a certain area of land around the stones, the land around that protected land was not protected, and there was in fact a derelict aerodrome very near the Stonehenge site that archaeologists and residents had been warning the government about for years at this point. The aerodrome was originally used as an airfield during the First World War. The aerodrome had now closed and the nearby buildings had been sold, but no one was doing anything with them, and people feared that the land would be bought up and developed into housing. So, after years of warning to the government about what might happen to the land, a group of people decided to come together in 1927 and campaign to raise money to buy the land around Stonehenge. And in 1929, they achieved their goal and raised enough money to buy the land around Stonehenge, the aerodrome and the buildings nearby. It cost them around £35,000, which is about £1.4 million in today's money. Another big spender.
That's so much.
So much money. The land was then pledged to the National Trust to protect it. The aerodrome was demolished, the site was cleared, other buildings and outhouses were also demolished, and the land was turned back into the grassland we see around Stonehenge today. Now, all of this served as a huge inspiration for Ferguson's gang. And with the National Trust at the centre of the protection of Stonehenge, it was clear that the National Trust was a glimmering piece of hope in their cause. Founded in 1895, the National Trust has been preserving heritage sites across the UK. Currently in 2024, the National Trust has over 5 million members and is the biggest conservation charity in Europe. Over the picnic, these women concluded they simply must act and do so by raising money for National Trust, but with a twist. Also, the fact that these women are just lounging during the day having a picnic, I'm getting the vibe of some aristocratic ladies.
Yeah, these are some fancy ladies. Like, why do you... Like, I feel like if you were in the workhouses, not that I think this is the workhouse era of time. We're a history podcast. But, like, if you were in that class, you probably wouldn't have time to be picnicking around.
No, and I feel like you probably wouldn't be like stressing about the landscape as much, you know what I mean? You
yes.
would be like, oh, my countryside that I like to frequent with my picnics is under a threat, you know?
What you'd can
be
we, like, and also I'm I feel working. Like you wouldn't have the idea that you have the power to do anything about it.
Mm.
You just kind of be like, oh, that sucks, doesn't it? Oh well.
Oh well.
I'm gonna scrub my pants in this massive metal tub now.
Yes, that's obviously what they did in the workhouse. But I like that they're ladies who lunch.
Yeah,
I can get on board.
I respect
with that.
It.
I really can.
Women getting things done.
Yeah. So the Ferguson's gang began to raise money for the National Trust. When they did raise the money, they delivered the money in very eclectic ways. For example, there were £100 notes stuffed inside fake cigars, very chic. Money placed inside a fake pineapple, also very chic, and we will come back to this. And they once delivered £500 in donation money paired with a bottle of slow gin. I would love if someone just gave me £500 and a bottle of slow gin.
Me too.
If any listeners can make that happen for us.
I was like, if you're listening, cash and gin.
Yes, please. As well as having fun in the delivering of their donations, the gang also came up with pseudonyms and code names for their members. The leader of the gang, though it is important to point out that there wasn't really ever a leader or a hierarchy in that way, but let's call them bill stickers, which referred to signs commonly put up in Britain that said,
"Bill stickers will be prosecuted,"
in reference to people putting up posters on buildings illegally. Other fake names included Kate O'Brien the Narc, in tribute to Kate O'Brien the Irish playwright, Sister Agatha, Red Biddy, and the Bloody Beer Shop. Their motto was, "England is Stonehenge, not Whitehall," in reference to their inspiration of Stonehenge. As we know, the aim of their mission was to raise money for key heritage sites under threat. One of their first rescues, as such, was in 1932 with Shalford Mill in Guildford, Surrey. The mill was part of the Godwin Austin family. That's a nice name. The mill was mentioned in the Domesday Book. For those who don't know, the Domesday Book is a record of a great survey of much of England and part of Wales, completed in 1086 at the will of William the Conqueror. He sent his men around the country to every shire to count up what he owned and what was owed to him. It's basically a very early record of everywhere in England and some of Wales. In other words, the mill was pretty old. And despite an impressive legacy, it was beginning to fall down.
Pretty old.
Pretty old.
Valuable in the sense of history, but not cash money. Because it was ramshackle.
Great word.
Thank you.
You looked very powerful when you said it.
I was really excited to say ramshackle.
The Ferguson's gang were determined the mill should be saved. Through their campaigning, they managed to raise enough money to buy the mill outright. When they got to it, it had been vandalised, with windows smashed, and it needed expensive work to restore it. They enlisted the help of a conservation architect by the name of John McGregor. Because of his help, he was made an honorary member of the Ferguson's gang. They even gave him his own pseudonym, Sexy John. I'm kidding.
Objectify John.
Sorry. No, so he was given his own pseudonym, the Artichoke, and the gang worked with him on other restoration projects. Once the mill was restored, the gang used it as a meeting place.
Do you know who he makes me think of? This is really niche. Did you ever read Far From the Madding Crowd by Thomas Hardy?
Yeah.
You know Gabriel Oak?
Yeah.
He gives real...
Big Gabriel.
He gives real John McGregor.
It's so
helping
true.
Out a woman yeah. with a task energy.
Mm. I wonder why he's called the Artichoke.
Because of the... I think it's
the architect.
Architect Artichoke.
I can kind of see it.
It's clever. This is smart women.
Mm-hmm. Now, back to the fake pineapple full of money that we mentioned a little while ago. In 1939, the gang actually unwittingly created a bomb scare at the National Trust's annual general meeting when they hired a messenger to deliver their latest donation, a £100 note stuffed inside a metallic pineapple. I feel like a metallic pineapple, that was like a trend for a while in people's houses.
Like recently, it's very Oliver Bonus.
Yeah.
And I have one. I should have brought it with me.
You should have brought it.
I keep jewellery in it.
And listeners can send us money. We can put it in there. Well, that would be nice.
The thing, like, this is what I was thinking, because pineapples must have been, like...
been hard to come by.
Yeah. They feel like the sort of thing that were quite rare back in those days. So these are rich women.
Well, I suppose it was metallic, so they'd...
Oh, that's true.
They'd maybe
but you
made
they
it.
Didn't have, like, Flying Tiger back then, so where were they getting a metallic pineapple
from?
That's
so true. They probably had to employ a... man who works
metallicist
with metallic things,
metal worker,
steelman.
These are the big questions.
These
that
are the big
Gap
questions.
Asks.
It's so true. You won't get that anywhere else. The parcel was handed from the committee secretary to the chairman, who was hugely anxious that it was an IRA, Irish Republican Army, bomb. The pineapple, as well as the cash, had a note that said, "Open this fruit and you will find a kernel greatly to your mind." To great relief, the chairman realised it ought to be a work of the Ferguson's gang. Though not ideal to say the least that the metallic pineapple caused a bomb scare, the story did make headlines, and the publicity from it meant they had more attention for their cause. So the pseudonyms are obviously very interesting. So far we've got Bill Stickers, Kate O'Brien the Narc, Sister Agatha, Red Biddy, the Bloody Beer Shop, and also the Artichoke.
I think the artichoke is my favourite.
The artichoke is good, actually.
And I also love...
also a very underrated vegetable.
And I can also see, like... because we're like, not to big up women, but like women just have a sense of fun and whimsy. Like, I really love the like image of these women being so pleased that this man helped them and being like, "We love you so much. You're going to be in our gang. We're making you your own name." And this guy just being like, "Guys, okay, I'm the artichoke now."
I feel like he'd be so chuffed.
Yeah, thrilled. I like that in our notes it just says the bomb scare is funny. Like, no question mark. The bomb scare is funny.
Objectively, it's quite a good... like,
it's a little bit funny.
If you were in... oh, it would be so hard to not talk about this, right? Because it's anonymous and all these things that were happening.
You just
like,
want to be like, oh, it's
like a dinner party. Like, guys, once I caused a bomb scare with a metallic pineapple.
Although looking at the time... like, so 1939 would have been like the beginnings of World War II. Mm. So maybe not
at the
very
time, it
funny.
It wasn't very funny.
In like hindsight.
I wonder if they felt bad. If they were like, oh, God.
I mean, they were giving them money.
I know.
Like, it wasn't like just a bomb scare for the sake of bomb scare. Like, there was cash in the fake bomb.
Yeah. There was purpose to the old bomb scare. The gang didn't just stop with the mill. Rather, they continued on with their conservation projects. In 1934, they rescued the old town hall in Newton on the Isle of Wight. In 1935 and 1936, they rescued Mayon and Treviskan Cliffs in Senin, Cornwall. In 1938, they rescued Priory Cottages in Stevington. And their final purchase was Frenchman's Creek in Cornwall in 1946. When they donated money, they left notes saying exactly what they wanted done with it. After all their exploits and the various buildings and bits of land they helped save, the gang mostly stayed anonymous. To this day, we don't know who all the members are. There's one member of Ferguson's gang who we do know, a woman called Margaret Pollard. She was a poet and a bard and is said to have been the founding member of Ferguson's gang, Bill Stickers.
Bill Stickers.
I think Bill Stickers is my favourite name.
Bill
Stickers is
such a slick name.
She was born Margaret Gladstone in 1904. She was the great-great-niece of former Prime Minister William Ewart Gladstone. And from 1920, she attended Newnham College, Cambridge, where she was the first woman to gain first-class honours in Oriental languages. Impressive.
Slay.
Slay. She married Captain Frank Pollard, who is an expert in Cornish history, and the two lived in Cornwall. By 1938, she worked as a bard, telling stories and reading poetry and writing books and plays. And of course, she worked to conserve the Cornish countryside and other areas of England that she felt needed protecting, along with the Ferguson's gang. She died in 1996 at the age of 93 in Truro, where she lived a rather pared-back life, choosing to give away large amounts of her wealth after her husband died in 1968. I really like the sound of Margaret.
I think she sounds really cool.
She sounds like she just... has lots of interesting hobbies and talents. And it's like, hey, here's some of my money.
And also, like...
give back.
Very aware that she comes from a privileged background.
Mm.
and kind of just takes what she needs and gives away the rest.
Yeah. Not to be sad for most famous people these days.
Mm.
Peggy, as Margaret was known to friends, revealed her part in the gang in a letter to the Times, which was sent after her death and her instructions. I like it. She's just keeping the intrigue going.
Oh, I really
like... This woman knows a PR stunt.
Not to be morbid, but just love whenever anyone is like, I've written all this stuff and it can only go out when I'm dead.
Mm.
I just think it's really chic.
Is there anything you would write in a letter?
I would write a letter to each of my enemies. Telling them exactly why I did them.
Mm.
But my plan is to outlive my enemies, so that doesn't really work because they'll be dead by the time I'm dead.
Yes.
So they're never going to get the letters. So I have to work out some sort of plan.
You could fake your own death.
That's true. Chic.
Chic.
You can't really do it anymore.
No, it's kind of very hard
There's
to not have
There's a book that I
want to
read
now.
About faking your own death because, like, the digital footprint means that it's basically impossible, but there's a book about all the, like, would be like the deaths that happened before the digital. So niche. This is my hyperfixation. There's a book which is about when people could fake their own deaths,
right?
And like instances of it that I'm going to buy and read. So,
well, let us know how you get on.
I'll update you all.
Next on the History Gap Twitter, Molly's dead. I've read about is she though? Because you know she was reading a book.
And they're like back for series 3.
Surprise, bitch! I'm back.
Ghost podcast.
According to the Carisbrook Castle Museum, a museum on the Isle of Wight, the members of Ferguson's gang had a great sense of fun, which I think is evident from the playful ways they handed in their donations and brought attention to themselves. Several of the members were also lesbian and bisexual and dressed in masculine ways. The gays always have more fun.
They love it. Like, and also, like, I love, it's kind of a similar time period of, like, Virginia Woolf and her gang.
Yep.
And I just love that they're all queering it up. It's great.
I really love it also. The gang closely noted and recorded all of their exploits in a minute book, a notebook, called The Boo. I like that it's called The Boo. Like, oh, just write it down in The Boo.
The Boo.
Just chuck it in The Boo.
Can't be bothered to say the letter K.
Oh, wrote that in The Boo. Yeah.
The book. Oh. Too much effort. The Boo.
You're very good with all these names. It took me long to get that they just dropped a K from that.
I mean, that's what I assume, but we don't know for sure.
It sounds logical. Not much research was done into Ferguson's gang until, according to the National Trust, a group of American visitors contacted them in 2011 to ask if they could see the room at Shelford Mill that the gang used to meet. The Trust were inspired to have a look back over the gang's history and see if they could fill in any blanks. A woman helping do just that is Polly Bagnall. She's a woman. She's a woman.
She's a woman.
She's a woman.
End of.
The end. Polly Bagnall's family had actually known the gang and had lived in the mill during this time. Through research and talking to her family and reading through the notes kept by the gang, they managed to discover more. Polly even found out that her grandfather, John McGregor, was the very same architect. The artichoke.
The architecture. The architechoke. The artichoke.
Oh my God,
why can't
right
I say
that?
Also, I wrote it wrong
things.
In the script. I wrote and earned the name the architect. And it's like, no, the name was the artichoke.
The artichoke.
So sorry.
Polly even found out that her grandfather, John McGregor, was the very same architect who helped the gang restore the buildings and earned the name The Artichoke. Polly and author Sally Beck have together written a book called Ferguson's Gang, The Remarkable Story of the National Trust Gangsters. The National Trust podcast have also featured the Ferguson's Gang. You can check that out by searching for the National Trust podcast. You've been listening to History Gap with me, Georgia McAndrew.
And me, Molly Goodfellow. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe and review if you can.
And keep an eye on our socials at History Gap on Instagram and TikTok at History Gap Pod on Twitter.
See you next time.
See you next time. Bye.
Bye.